I want to quickly finish this list of 50 characteristics, and I don't want to spend tons of time. I just want to quickly go through it so that you have it. What a lot of you are finding is some of these are describing you or your kids, and it's making you a little panicky or guilty. That happens. What I hope you're also seeing is all of these are interconnected. And so what I get with clients is, which one do I start on? And what they think is, I got to work on 50 in sequence. And I go, you start on one, and what you'll realize is you're working on all of them at the same time. So you can pick wherever you want to begin, but they're all connected. Okay, so authority issues, I mentioned that, ODD, oppositional defiance. And then they abuse authority when they finally get it. So, oh, now I can get my needs met. Now I can be my own boss. And then the fears, and we touched on these, but fear is the theme that comes out of complex trauma. Fear of change. Why? Because if something changes, something might hurt me. So change is suspect, fear of the unknown for the same reason. And so a lot of addicts, if you talk to them, they grill you for details. They want to know every little detail about what is planned. And it can drive you crazy. What's going on there, though? They're trying to protect against the unknown. If I know everything that will happen, then I can stop anything bad from happening. And so sometimes they come and they'll grill me, and I go, I don't have a crystal ball. And they go, but. And I go, there's trust involved. And that scares them to death. Because to not be in control with all this fear and not have every detail means I got to trust somebody. And that's really what it boils down to. Fear of failure, huge, because failure always meant you got punished or shamed. And then fear of success. This is we talked about it, but it's important to understand. Many addicts, as soon as life gets successful, they sabotage it. Because they're pretty sure something bad's going to happen anyways. It always has. And so success is a scary thing for them. And it's important to be aware of that. And we talked about they want to hope, but they're afraid to hope. And we talked about what they're trying to avoid, they end up creating. So think of it this way. Somebody that didn't get validated. Could it? Oh, it doesn't show up. So they're probably below the PowerPoint. I just don't know what they are off the top of my head. So if you're wanting notes, Laura's going to print them up. And I think you're going to put them online, too, if people want to download them. Chris, you were just raised.
That's great.
Okay. I'm glad you pointed that out. I just don't know right now what it has to do. Okay. So what you create. So if a person never wants to be abandoned, then if they start to feel they're going to be abandoned, they do all kinds of crazy things. They test the other person. Oh, you don't need me. Push them away to see if they'll go away. And then they get angry at them, accuse them of cheating on them, all because they don't want to be abandoned. They're testing the other person. But what happens? The other person gets tired of the games and walks away. And they created what they're trying to prevent. And so that is the ongoing thing. Super responsible or super irresponsible. So the perfectionist. So if I'm perfect, everybody will respect me and love me. So complex trauma people set unrealistic expectations for themselves. And because of that, they're always beating themselves up. Others, people pleasers, if I do whatever you want, you'll love me and respect me. Image is more important than authenticity, we talked about, and they don't know who they are. So they've worn masks for so long, they really don't know who they are. And so that is a journey for them that is very scary. Boundaries are huge for people in complex trauma. And I teach a whole week of stuff on boundaries with clients because it is so important. But most, they don't know how to say no, or they're afraid to say no. If they do say no, they feel guilty. And so what usually happens is this. They say yes to everybody. Will you help us here? Yes. Will you help us here? Yes. And before you know it, they are overwhelmed, and then they get a resentment. But they don't know how to set a boundary, so they do one of two things to set that boundary. They either isolate or they explode. I drive everybody away because I get angry. That's their only way of setting a boundary. But then when they drive everybody away out of anger, they feel guilty. So then they go, oh, I'm a terrible person, I'm so selfish, and they let everybody use them and walk all over them again, and then they explode again. And you get this yo-yo effect that starts to happen. But boundaries are big, and so boundaries were never consistent, or they are very rigid, or they were unfair, and so they just have no idea how to have healthy relationships. When a person sets a boundary, so if you think of it this way, a guy's dating a girl, and she says, the relationship's done, no. Do you know what no means for many people from complex trauma? It doesn't mean no, it means try harder. So now the guy's texting her 1,000 times in a day, phoning her, begging her, give me another chance, showing up with roses, and all of that, and stalking her, basically. And then finally she says, oh, okay, I'll say hello to him. Oh, he just won. You just trained him that if he tries hard enough, he can get whatever he wants. And so that is the ongoing challenge. So for many people with complex trauma, you set a boundary and it feels cruel. But they're not going to learn unless you stick to it until they accept it. But they think they can somehow manipulate past it. And that is a huge, if you're working with addicts, don't forget that. Be consistent and enforce and stick to the boundaries that are healthy. Attachment issues, we talked about a huge problem. Afraid to be a burden or a pain, addicted to chaos. Common thing. So here's what I do with addicts. I draw on the board. Here's what normal relationships look like in addicts. Extreme highs, extreme lows. In a healthy relationship, here's what a relationship looks like. So if you come out of complex trauma, what does this feel like? Boring. And so what do? I have to get to the high to feel alive. So I create chaos. I create drama. And so without realizing it, many people in complex trauma hate trauma, but they're addicted to trauma and drama. And so they recreate it. Great starters, poor finishers. I tell clients all the time, the best person in the world to hire is an addict for the first week. Then it gets boring. And then it's routine. Then they got to be responsible. And so the limbic brain says, I do a job as long as I feel like doing a job. As soon as it gets boring, I don't feel like it, I quit. That makes sense to a limbic brain. And so they are impulsive, instant gratification. That's the focus. So to get to the healthy cerebral cortex adult brain, you have to learn to stick at something and do it even when you don't feel like it. And that is one of the hardest skills for people to learn. And everything in their life becomes boredom. And so to live with that and learn how to live with that is so important. Distorted view of love. So love for a person with complex trauma usually means oxytocin, which means intensity. So if I have intense feelings, I must be in love. Second thing it means is sex. If we have sex, we must be in love. Third thing is if I feel sorry for you, I must be in love. Because I pity you. Oh, poor you. Oh, I have such warm feelings to you. I just want to rescue you. I must love you. They have no idea what love is, but they got all these distortions. And then if you add sexual abuse in that, and women that have gained attention through promiscuity and body image stuff, then it's just so confused. And so I spend a lot of time trying to help people understand what is healthy love. And many of them, it's like me trying to explain snow and minus 30 to somebody in the Sahara Desert. It's just foreign. In case you didn't know, it was minus 30 when we left Winnipeg on Friday. So now you don't need to be jealous of me at all. The rain looks really good. Okay, next, because of all that shame, you're insecure. What will people think when they find out about me? Am I pretty enough? Am I smart enough? All of that. And many have a great fear of being stupid or looking stupid. And many have a great fear of doing something that's embarrassing. Okay? But what then happens when they get in a relationship is they think for sure the other person's going to leave them as soon as they find out. So jealousy becomes part of their relationships. And it can be super intense, super destructive, lots of anger, lots of control. And so usually what happens in relationships is they think you will love me if I'm the only person in your life. So I will cut out everybody in your life. I will cut out your family. I will cut out your friends. I will cut out your activities so that you need me for everything. And that's their solution to both love and jealousy. Doesn't work, but that makes sense in their mind. Healthy, don't know what healthy loyalty is. So many of the addicts that I talk to, when I start talking about their upbringing, they get very annoyed because they feel like if they look honestly at their family, they're being disloyal. If they're saying their family was not healthy, what kind of child am I? And so it's really hard for them to look honestly at a situation because disloyalty was pounded into them. They grew up hearing, you don't need anybody but your family. And if we're family, you always have each other's back. That was loyalty. And so you never looked at it honestly. And so it's really tough for them to learn what healthy loyalty is. So when you take that to a street level, healthy loyalty is you never rat somebody out. You keep their secrets and never let them experience negative consequences. What is interesting for me is they don't say, don't rat me out if I do something good. No, rat me out all you want if I do something good. It's don't rat me out if I've done something illegal. And so that becomes their definition of loyalty. Next one, huge, especially for church people. Many addicts get stuck in victim mode. Self-pity, victim mentality. Here's kind of what works with me. I call it help requesters, help rejectors. I get people say, Tim, please, I got a problem. Help me, help me. And they're in a crisis. And I tell them what I think they should do, and I lay it out and explain it, and then they don't do it. But then 2 weeks later, Tim, please help me, help me, help me. And I go through that a couple times, and I go, well, you know what? You like being a victim. That's how you get attention, by having a problem and a crisis, and you suck people in. But I'm a busy guy, and I got lots of people that want genuine help that are willing to change. So if you're not going to follow my advice, I'm not going to talk to you. Now that is so important for churches to do. Because guess what those people find are the biggest suckers? Christians. They can be victim mode forever, and Christians will just keep bailing them out. And it is very destructive for them. But they get angry when you won't bail them out anymore. And you say, if you're willing to change and you're willing to put in the energy, then I'll be right at your side. And I will help you. But if you're just wanting me to fix you and me to do all the work, we got a problem. So I say this to clients. If I realize that I'm working harder than you on you, this isn't working. And you got to make some changes or I'm out of here. So that's very, very important. Deep longing for validation. It is just a consuming thing. And they find subtle ways to try to get pats on the back because they never got it. And sometimes you just kind of say, I don't even want to give them any pats on the back because they feel so needy all the time. Or they're fishing for compliments. But you have to keep that in mind. False guilt or irrational guilt. Here's what would happen. Dad would say to them growing up, I drink because you're such a bad kid. So they feel guilty that they caused their dad to drink. That's false guilt. They're not guilty. They didn't do anything wrong. But they've been made to think they're guilty. And if you look at the guilt within addicts, a lot of it is stuff they did that's legitimate guilt, but they pick up guilt. So I say to clients all the time, if there's conflict in the house and we have to kick somebody out of the program, how many of you feel guilty? Every hand goes up. They didn't do anything wrong. They just go, if something went wrong, maybe I did something wrong, I'm guilty. And they just pick up guilt all the time. And so as a leader or as a Christian, one of the things that many churches have done is try to create guilt to motivate. And there's a legitimate part to that because we are guilty in many ways. But they just come to church sometimes and they just hear guilt, 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 and they walk away so discouraged with zero hope. And so we have to really do a better job, I think, at handling the guilt, because so much of their guilt is false guilt. Stop growing emotionally. And we talked about that at the age that they started fight, flight, or freeze. Distorted thinking, we talked about, and depression. So there's an element of depression that is clinical. It is a chemical imbalance in the brain. And you need medication. I live with depression. I'm on medication. I wouldn't be able to live without it. But there is an element of complex trauma that is what we call circumstantial depression. Life sucks. So when you grow up feeling nobody loves me, and you grow up in abusive or neglect, abandonment situations, that's depressing. And so everybody, even if they're the life of the party or funny, funny guy that everybody wants to be around, if they're from complex trauma, they just live with a constant depression under the surface. Get them away from the party, get them away from the friends, and they just, life sucks. And so there's depression that is there. One of the things that does tremendous damage, the church has done a terrible job up until recently on mental health. And they have stigmatized it and said, if you're depressed, you must not be trusting God. You must not be have enough faith. And they've made them feel guilty for being depressed. And the same with anxiety. They say Philippians 4 says, be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer. And so they go, your anxiety, you're sinning. No, they got a chemical imbalance in the brain. But to have that put in terms, you're sinning, that's a different kind of anxiety where you're not trusting God. That's very different than a chemical imbalance type of anxiety. But if we don't make that distinction, we cause a lot of people to feel hopeless before they hardly get in the pew. And so that depression, anxiety, how we respond to that is important. I have seen so many people afraid to go into church, and I get clients all the time who have gone to church and they have still been told they just need more faith. Then they'll be done with all of that. And they just are so defeated and discouraged and think they're a terrible Christian, etc. So that's the 50. So when I teach this to clients, I get them to check off which ones are true of them at any time in their upbringing and life, and then which ones put a star beside the ones that are their main struggle areas now. So most of them, they will have 40 to 50 of those that they check off that has been part of how they've coped, and they'll have about 10 to 20 that they still struggle with on a daily basis. So that is a lot of stuff to have to work on. But that comes out of the complex trauma.